You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha. This is Lecture 2, entitled The Trichotomy of Man and of the Universe. Let us recall the main points of the last lecture. I said in it that to arrive at a true and soul-satisfying understanding of the world, it was necessary that the being of man and of the universe should be divided into three principles, body, soul, and spirit. It is most necessary that this fact should be accepted with intenseness at the present time. In my book titled Theosophy, I explained this, and said that in the comprehension of this threefold partition lay the kernel of the whole matter. You have read the book referred to and will know that the whole work is constructed round this idea, which on page 71 I express as follows, quote, "The spirit is eternal. In all that appertains to the body, birth and death hold sway in accordance with physical laws. The soul, the life of which is regulated by destiny, acts as intermediary between these two during life on earth." Close quote. It is necessary that this should be explained in the clearest way, for it is only by placing trichotomy at the central point of our discourse that the necessary standpoint is found for an understanding of the mystery of Golgotha as the central event of our whole evolution. In the last lecture, I spoke of the opposition this idea had encountered in the spiritual evolution of the West, so that among official philosophers of the present day, there are none who are able to distinguish clearly between soul and spirit. Even among those who think they are building on a foundation of unprejudiced thought, we find everywhere most prejudiced assertions, similar to that of the Eighth Ecumenical Council, in which the dogma was laid down that man consisted of body and soul alone. Anyone who truly recognizes the life of the spirit, not only as found in the domain of superficial philosophy, but as it is found deeply embedded in the thought and feeling of all men, will realize how strong was the influence which the exclusion of the idea of the spirit had upon the spiritual life of the West. There has been a tendency in recent times to introduce into the West certain ideas derived from the wisdom of the East. These have been presented in such a light that it is hardly possible to glimpse the thought that at the root of all conceptions of the world and of man there lies this threefold partition. According to Eastern teaching, in the partition of the being of man into dense body, etheric body, and astral body, or kama manas, as they call it, and in all the various other partitions which, without authority, are ranked in rows of seven, nothing is found of what matters most, vis-à-vis the necessity that all our conceptions regarding the universe and man should be permeated with this threefold quality. We are therefore justified in saying that all idea of man's threefold nature has been hidden from view. We certainly hear the spirit spoken of a great deal at the present time, but what we hear is mere words. For people are unable to distinguish nowadays between mere words and realities. Hence many publications are taken seriously, which are but what I might call a kaleidoscopic jumble of words, such as the philosophy of Eucken. The essential nature of the mystery of Golgotha cannot be understood if the trichotomy of man is not accepted. The dogma promulgated at the Eighth Ecumenical Council had been in preparation for a long time, and its fulfillment was really a consequence of the progress of the spiritual life of the West. We will, perhaps, be able to approach the mystery of Golgotha most easily from this side if we first form a conception of the way in which Aristotle, who stood at the apex of Greek thought, pictured the soul. Aristotle is that philosopher who gave the keynote to all the philosophy of the Middle Ages. And though people do not always allow it, modern thought is to a great extent still nourished by the thought of the Middle Ages. Moreover, what had evolved in the course of history up to a few centuries before the time of Christ is revealed by Aristotle. And it was with the help of his ideas that the leading minds of the Middle Ages sought to understand the mystery of Golgotha. There is something so deeply important in these matters that we must really take the trouble to investigate them with an open mind. What were the thoughts of Aristotle in regard to the human soul? I will tell you, without circumlocution, what the Greeks thought on this subject as set forth by Aristotle. We have here the thoughts of an enlightened mind regarding the human soul, the thoughts of the most renowned European of two or three centuries before the time of Christ. His thoughts were as follows. When an individual enters earthly evolution at birth, or rather at conception, he has to thank his father and mother for his physical existence. From our parents, Aristotle holds, we receive only what determines bodily existence. The entire man could never come into being merely through the union of father and mother, for man has a soul. And one part of the soul, parenthesis, here we see clearly that Aristotle distinguishes two parts within the soul, close parenthesis, is completely bound to the body, finds expression through the body, and receives, by means of the bodily senses, its impressions of the outer world. That part of the soul, which comes from parents, appears as the necessary result of material evolution. With regard to the spiritual part of the soul, or as Aristotle calls it, the thinking part, it is otherwise. It is the part that participates in the general spiritual life of the universe through thought. It has a share in the nous, N-O-U-S, the thinking of the world. This part of the soul is non-material, and could never result from what the parents have to give, but only because God, or as Aristotle says, divinity, has a part in it. It is thus that man, the whole man, comes into being. It is important that Aristotle has said, the complete man comes into existence through the cooperation of God with the father and mother. From God man receives his spiritual nature, the thinking part of his soul. This thinking part of the soul, which comes into being with each individual physical man through divine cooperation, is in evolution during life between birth and death. When he passes through the gates of death, man's bodily part is given over to the earth, and with it that part of the soul which is bound to the physical organs of the body. On the other hand, the spiritual part of the soul endures. Thus, according to Aristotle, the life of this spiritual part of the soul continues. It is withdrawn to another world than that with which man is connected through his bodily organs, and it continues to lead there an immortal existence. Aristotle says of this immortal existence that a man who did this or that good action while in the body can look back on the good he has built into and united with the edifice of the world, but that he has no power over what he has done in this respect. Aristotle can only be rightly understood when this idea of his is accepted, vis-à-vis that through all eternity souls look back after death on the good and evil they have brought about. In the 19th century, more especially, the most strenuous mental effort was made from every side to grasp this idea. For owing to his manner of expressing himself, Aristotle is not always easy of comprehension. The late Franz Brentano, in his controversy with Edward Zeller, endeavored throughout his whole life to gather every scrap of evidence wherewith to construct a clear conception of what Aristotle thought regarding the relationship of the spiritual part of man to man as a whole. What Aristotle thought passed over into the philosophy taught all through the Middle Ages and down to recent times, and is indeed still taught in certain clerical circles today. Franz Brentano pursued this idea keenly, so far as it had its source in Aristotle. He explains the matter as follows, quote, "The mind of Aristotle, which in the quality of its thought rose far above materialism, could not submit to the belief that the spiritual part of man's soul was in any way material, or that it could be evolved from that which man receives through father and mother. Therefore, so says Brentano, there were but two possible ways in which Aristotle could think of the soul. One was that the spiritual part of the soul was created through a direct divine act of creation in conjunction with the parents, so that the spiritual part of the soul arose through divine action upon the human embryo, that this did not perish at death, but entered then upon an eternal life." Close quote. If this idea were rejected, what, asks Brentano, was left to Aristotle? He thought the idea that Aristotle had arrived at was correct. For what was left to him if he did not accept it? There was but one alternative and no third. The second possibility was this, that he should admit the pre-existence of men's souls in spiritual realms before conception. Brentano saw quite clearly that so soon as it is granted that the soul had any existence before conception, there is no other course than to allow this soul, to allow that this soul does not incorporate in one life only, but that it appears continually in other earthly lives. There is no other possibility than this. But as in later life, Aristotle denies palingenesis, that is, repeated earthly lives, nothing was left to him but to allow the complete new creation of a human soul with each embryonic act of creation by man. This does not deny post-existence, but only pre-existence. And it seemed to Brentano to be reasonable on the part of Aristotle to deny the teaching of reincarnation, and to hold only to that of post-existence and the individual creation of souls. Footnote: Brentano was originally a priest, and was one of the last to enter fully into what has evolved as the good side of Aristotelian scholastic philosophy. Close parenthesis. It is strange, I might almost say distressing, to see how an eminent thinker, such as Franz Brentano, who had laid aside the priestly cassock, makes every endeavor to arrive at greater clarity regarding the theory of the individual creation of the soul, and yet how impossible it seemed for him, in spite of his great ability, to form a bridge that would lead him to the teaching of reincarnation. What was the reason for this? It was that in spite of his ability and his clear energetic thinking, the idea of the spirit was withheld from him. He was never able to attain to this, or to recognize the spirit as separate from the soul. It is not possible to attain to the idea of the spirit without accepting the idea of reincarnation. The teaching of reincarnation has only been lost to those who have lost the idea of the spirit in general. As a matter of fact, all idea of the spirit had already fallen into decay at the time of Aristotle. We can notice how in the clearly defined sentences of his writings, he always becomes unclear, indefinite, when he speaks of pre-existence. He is vague about it. All this is connected with something of very great profundity and importance. It is connected with the true evolution of mankind. It is connected with the fact that a few centuries before the time of the mystery of Golgotha, man entered on a stage of evolution in which a mist seemed to surround his soul whenever the spirit was mentioned. This mist was not so dense then as it is now. But the process of decay in the power of his thoughts regarding the spirit began at that time. The fact is that humanity in the course of time had passed through an evolution, and souls had become somewhat different to what they were at an earlier stage of development. In the primeval stages of human evolution, because man possessed atavistic clairvoyance, he experienced the spirit directly. It was impossible for him, at that time, to doubt the existence of the spirit. It was but a matter of his gaining a greater or less perception of it. That the path to the spirit was open to the souls of men in past ages was not doubted for a moment. It was also never doubted that during life between birth and death, something of a spiritual nature dwelt in the souls of men by which they could participate in divine life. This sure conviction regarding the spirit, which is founded on direct consciousness of it, is expressed everywhere in the mysteries and in the practices of the mysteries. We note also a remarkable thing, which is that one of the most ancient of the Greek philosophers, Heraclitus, speaks of the mysteries in such a way that we can see he knows that in olden times the mysteries were of immense importance to mankind, but that they had already in his day fallen from their original high estate. Many things were cherished in the mysteries, but it is only the central idea with which they are concerned that specially interests us today. We will dwell for a moment on this central idea as practiced by them up to the time of the mystery of Golgotha, and indeed up to the time of the Emperor Julian, for much appertaining to the cult of the mysteries reappeared in later times in what one might call an anti-Christian sense. We cannot help noticing that what people call the, quote, Easter legend, close quote, that which contains the central legend of the passion, death, and resurrection of Christ, formed a vital part of the mysteries also. The conclusion drawn from this was that the Christian Easter mystery was in fact a kind of continuation of practices to be found in ancient heathen mysteries, or a transference of these to the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And thus it does appear to many persons who do not doubt the truth contained in this idea. They say, quote, what Christians say of the divine Christ, that he suffered, was put to death, and rose again, that with his resurrection is associated the hope and longing for the salvation of man, all that Christians have built on these ideas is also to be found in the various cults of the mysteries. Heathen customs have been drawn from all directions and united into the Easter legend, which has then been transferred to the person of Jesus of Nazareth. Close quote. Recently, people have gone even further. In officially Christian circles, they have even disregarded, to an extraordinary extent, the historical existence of Jesus of Nazareth, declaring that all kinds of things have been collected from the legends and cults of the mysteries, that these have been centralized, and that from them the legend of the Christ has been constructed. It is true that infinite possibilities for error and deception have sprung from the study of the heathen mystery cults, and from the endeavor to compare these with the Christian Easter mystery. Let us consider in this connection the account of a Phrygian celebration of the Easter festival. This account, which is considered to be trustworthy, may be held to be typical, for the similarity in these rites, in these rituals, was widespread. Firmicus tells in a letter to his son Constantine how a Phrygian Easter celebration was conducted. He writes, quote, "The image of the god Attis was bound to the stem of a tree, and bound thus was carried round in a midnight procession, while the sufferings of the god were honored. near to the tree a lamb was placed. When day appeared, the resurrection of the god was proclaimed. The previous day, while the god was bound to the tree, and apparently given over to death, the most dreadful lamentations broke forth as part of the ritual. These were now suddenly changed into unrestrained expressions of joy, in which the resurrection of the god was celebrated. Close quote. Firmicus tells us that in other places the image of the god Attis was buried. During the night, when the lamentations and mourning had reached a climax, suddenly a light was kindled and the grave was opened. The god had risen. The priest then said these words, quote, "Take comfort, ye pious ones, the god is saved. So for you also has salvation, which was necessary, taken place." Close quote. Who can deny that in this ritual, which was celebrated hundreds and hundreds of years before the mystery of Golgotha, there is great similarity to the celebrations of the Easter mystery carried out all through Christendom? Because of the misleading quality of this thought, many people have believed that the conception of the suffering, dying, and risen Lord was universal, and that it had in some way become transferred by the Christians to Jesus of Nazareth. It is important that we should understand from what all these pre-Christian celebrations came. They reached back a very long way, back to those times when the mysteries first evolved from an original, profound insight into the nature of man and into his relationship with the world as disclosed to atavistic clairvoyance. It is true that at the time these Phrygian ceremonies were carried out, people knew as little of the true meaning of such things as do the Freemasons of the present day, of the significance of the ceremonial in certain of their temples. All these matters reach back to a great, quote, original wisdom, close quote, dealing with the world and man, a wisdom it is exceedingly difficult to make comprehensible at the present time. You have but to realize that man does not live merely in that which surrounds his physical body, but that with soul and spirit he also lives in all his external surroundings. His conceptions and ideas are drawn from these. He is accustomed to them, and for many reasons he cannot escape them. A person may, therefore, find it difficult, even with the best will in the world, to understand certain things that have been lost to the spiritual evolution of mankind. The science of today is concerned only with outermost surface of things, and little with that which can lead to their true nature. One must certainly admire science in that it has attained to wireless telegraphy, to many other things that play an important part in our day. But we may ask, quote, what might we have had, supposing we had not had these things? Close quote. If we went far with the unraveling of this question, we would come hard up against that which it is forbidden to mention today. Modern science naturally considers the wisdom, parenthesis, the last already corrupt remnants of which were to be found in the practices of the mysteries, close parenthesis, as madness. This may well be. St. Paul tells us that what men regard as folly is often the wisdom of God. True insight into the nature of the world and of man discloses, among other things, a certain knowledge of the human organism, which seems quite mad to modern science. For instance, the human organism is entirely different to that of animals. I have already mentioned some of these differences. Today I will speak of those which have interest for us in connection with the mystery of Golgotha. The organism of man is entirely different to that of animals, for the organism of animals, when studied by the methods of occult science, is seen to bear within it the natural impulse to death. In other words, when you have learned really to investigate the animal organism by means of occult science, you will be able to state that from its composition it must pass through death. as indeed it does. The necessity for the death of animals is revealed by the nature of their organism. Now this necessity does not arise in respect to the nature of the human organism. We contact here a realm that remains entirely incomprehensible to modern science. When studied with the aid of spiritual science, the human organism is found to contain nothing that of itself necessitates death. We must accept death in man as something which he simply experiences and which cannot be explained, for man was not originally born to die. Neither was he, as an external organism, born to die. The fact that death occurs in man from within is not to be explained through human nature as such. From human nature, purely as human nature, death is not explainable. I realize very well that what I have said will be regarded as utter folly by those who stand at the summit of the natural science of the day. It is indeed very difficult to make oneself comprehensible as regards these matters, for one comes up against things that cannot be expressed otherwise than by the methods employed by St. Martin in his book Des Erreurs et de la Vérité, to which I have already referred. Thus, in an important passage, St. Martin, when speaking of the consequences that resulted to the nature of man from a certain event that took place in spiritual realms before he had incorporated physically for the first time, says, quote, "However much I may desire that people should understand, yet just as much does my feeling of responsibility forbid the least enlargement on this subject, and further, I would, for my part, rather blush for man's shortcomings than speak of them." Close quote. For St. Martin would in this case have to speak of a trespass of mankind before his first entrance into incarnation. This he cannot do. Now, for certain reasons, we are able to speak of some things today which St. Martin could not speak of in his time. This is not that man has become better since that time, but for many other reasons. If, however, we were to publish such truths as, quote, "that man is not born to die," close quote, and the many other things that would have to be considered in connection with this truth, things would have to be mentioned that cannot be listened to by the generality of ears at the present time. Man is not born to die, yet he dies. In these words, something is expressed which, to the sages of modern science, would seem foolishness, but to those who are able to penetrate to a true understanding of the world, is connected with the profoundest realms of the mysteries. The consciousness that man was not born to die, yet dies, passes like a hidden impulse through all those ancient mysteries, even the Attic mystery of which I have spoken. The possibility of understanding these words was sought within the mysteries. There, in some way, an answer was to be found to the riddle, quote, "Man is not born to die, yet he dies." Why were the mysteries of which we have spoken enacted? They were enacted each year so that something which men desired to hear might be said, something which they desired to experience and to realize within their souls. They desired to hear that as yet the time was not come when they would, in all seriousness, have to face this death, the cause of which was to them inexplicable. What did a believer in the Attic mysteries look for from his priests? Such a man had the instinctive consciousness that a time would one day come when it would be of very great importance to him to understand the reason of this unexplainable death. Quote, "The time is not yet come," close quote, so the words of the priest were understood, quote, "when it is necessary to seriously take in hand the understanding of death," close quote. In the ancient times with which we are dealing, it was known that the events recounted at the beginning of the Old Testament referred to facts, that they were not merely symbolic, as is often said today. It is modern materialism that first outgrew the instinctive knowledge, that the temptation by Lucifer referred to a real event. The type of thought that finds expression in materialistic Darwinism is far removed from what we regard as the truth. It holds that animals of a kind existed in that ancient time, and that these gradually evolved into the humanity of today. In such material conceptions, the story of the temptation in paradise has, of course, no place, for it presupposes a very low mentality to believe in the possibility of a prehistoric ape being tempted by Lucifer. There has always existed an instinctive certainty that a single important fact lay at the back of the stories told at the beginning of the Old Testament. How were men conscious of this fact? They felt that man was not as originally organized mortal. But because of this, in quotes, fact, something had entered into his physical organism by which it had been corrupted, and which was the cause of his now having the tendency to mortality. Man became mortal through a moral event, through that which is contained in the mysterious words of the fall. Originally, man was not mortal in the same sense as other living creatures in nature are mortal. He did not become mortal through any event that can be thought out scientifically. He became mortal through a moral event. He became mortal from the soul out. The animal soul, as species soul, is immortal, and this species soul incorporates in separate individuals of the animal creation. These animals, because of their organism, are mortal. The species soul leaves the mortal animal the same as when it entered it. That which, as human group soul, lies at the root of the human organism, is able to find expression in the individual man, and makes him immortal as separate human organism. Man could only become mortal through a moral act, through an act springing from the soul. In a certain sense, the soul had to be undone before man could become mortal. If such ideas are accepted as one accepts abstract ideas, they can by no means be understood. It is only by rising to actual concrete conceptions that this can be done. In the days when the rites of the ancient mysteries were observed, and even not so very long before the mystery of Golgotha, the knowledge was instinctive that it was through his soul that man had come to, that death had come to man. Throughout the ages, the souls of men have been in progressive evolution. In what does this consist? In this, that the soul participates ever more and more in corruption, and in consequence works ever more destructively upon the organism. Through the instinctive knowledge to which I have referred, men gazed back to ancient times and said, "Long ago a moral event took place, which has been the cause of the soul becoming what it now is, so that now, when it dwells in a body, it destroys it." The soul, therefore, cannot live between birth and death, as it would have done if this damaging process had not occurred. In the course of hundreds and thousands of years, the condition of the soul has grown worse and worse. Thus men felt and spoke long ago. The further human evolution advances, the more difficult it becomes to find the path leading to the spirit. And the more the body is corrupted by the soul, the more intensely it is inoculated with death. A time must therefore come when it will no longer be possible for a soul which has completed its span of existence on earth to find its way back again into the spiritual world. It was this point of time that was looked forward to with such dread and horror in ancient times. The people felt that as the generations passed, a time would come when souls would have so strongly impregnated bodies with death that they would no longer be able to find their way back to divinity. Tremendous importance was therefore attached to the words of the priest when he said, quote, "Take comfort, ye pious ones, God is saved. For you the necessary salvation is assured." Close quote. In these words the priest sought to comfort the people, quote, "God is still with you," close quote, he said. We contact here an infinitely profound stratum of feeling which stirred the souls of men at one period of human evolution, and of which the average individual has no longer the least idea. These ancient people possessed these very deep feelings, though they were simple and illiterate, and had no idea of what we call modern culture. In schools where the last tradition of that which sprang from the old clairvoyant wisdom was still preserved, those seeking initiation were told, quote, "You must realize that had evolution continued as it was under the influence of that moral event which took place at the beginning of earthly evolution, the souls of men would have followed a path that led them ever further from God, and they would finally have entered a world which they themselves had made, in which the human organism would have tended ever more rapidly to corruption and death. Souls would have been bound to the earth, and through it to the underworld." Close quote. Such souls would have been lost. They would have returned no more. Because knowledge regarding the spirit was still preserved in these schools, it was known that man consisted of body, soul, and spirit. What I have just said refers to the soul, not the spirit, for the spirit is eternal and follows its own laws. This truth was known at the time with which we are dealing. It was necessary to warn the people that it was possible souls might disappear in the underworld, though the spirit would reappear in ever-repeated earthly lives. Earthly evolution was faced with a future in which the spirits of men would incarnate continually. They would be able to gaze back on their soul nature as it had once been in earthly existence, but the souls would be lost. They would return no more. Spirits would return, and they would stimulate the human body automatically, without the way in which this was done being perceived or felt by the soul. What, then, were the feelings of those who strove to participate in the Christian Easter mystery? They felt that unless something different came to pass than had existed from of yore, men would one day appear on earth who would be soulless. They expected something new. They looked for something that was outside the normal course of evolution, something that would have to enter earthly life from without. In other words, they awaited the mystery of Golgotha. They looked for a time when, in the slow course of the ages, a being would appear on earth who would save the souls of men from death. The spirit did not need to be saved, but the soul and everything appertaining to the nature of the soul had need of being saved from the death that was approaching. The being who, by uniting himself with the body of Jesus of Nazareth, now entered into earthly evolution from without, was recognized as the Christ who had come to save the souls of men. In the Christ, men have that with which they may unite their souls, so that through this union, souls may lose the corrupting force which destroys the body, and may gradually recover that which they had lost. This is why the mystery of Golgotha must be regarded as the central point in human evolution. From the beginning of this evolution, up to the time of the mystery of Golgotha, everything was deteriorating more and more through the corrupting power which found its way increasingly into the souls of men, making of them automata of the spirit. But from the mystery of Golgotha onward, until the end of earthly existence, all that was lost will gradually be retrieved once more. So that when the evolution of the earth comes to an end, the spirits of men will be incorporating in their final bodies, and these bodies will be once more immortal. It was in this way, with this hope before them, that men understood the mystery of Easter. Before this could come to pass, however, it was necessary that the power that had corrupted the souls of men should be overcome. And it was overcome by that unique fact which Christianity recognizes as the fact of Golgotha. The early Christians, those who had knowledge, looked for something to happen from outside that would weaken the power of this corrupting force. For them, the words that resounded from the cross, quote, "It is finished," close quote, were a sign that the time had now begun when that corrupting force could be overcome. What a marvelous event, and one comprising what stupendous mysteries! Vast indeed are the questions that assail us when the mystery of Golgotha is under consideration. We will find, when our studies of this great event have gone further, that it is impossible to think of the mystery of Golgotha without also thinking of the risen Christ. This is most important. Indeed, it is essential. In one of his most profound pronouncements, St. Paul says, quote, "If Christ had not risen, then our preaching and our faith also is vain." Close quote. The risen Christ belongs to Christianity once and for all. And without the risen Christ, there is no Christianity. Death also belongs to it, the death of Christ. Do but consider, how is the matter represented, and how must it be represented? An innocent being was put to death with suffering. Those who thus put him to death took a heavy burden of guilt openly upon themselves, for he who suffered was innocent. They took a heavy burden of guilt on themselves, yet what was this for the rest of humanity? It was the salvation of humanity. For if Christ had not died, salvation would not have come to man. We are confronted here with the extraordinary fact, forcing us to acknowledge that the greatest benefit that could possibly have come to earthly humanity is this, that Christ was slain. The heaviest guilt that humanity has taken upon itself is this, that Christ was slain. The salvation of man and his greatest guilt here coincide. A superficial mind can pass this lightly by, but those who look a little below the surface see it as one of the profoundest riddles of existence. From the most horrible murder of all time has sprung the salvation of humanity. Try to understand this riddle. We must endeavor at least to understand it, if we are to gain any understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. A stimulus is given to this understanding in the words that resound from the cross, quote, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." Close quote. In the right comprehension of these words is to be found the answer to that profound problem, why the most horrible murder should bring about the salvation of mankind. From what has been said, you will see that the mystery of Golgotha must be approached with the idea of body, soul, and spirit. It was for the souls of man that Christ died. It is the souls of men he brings back once more to the spiritual world, from which they would have been cut off if he had not come to earth. Morality would have disappeared from earth. Driven by a necessity in which morality had no part, the spirit would have entered into automatic bodies. The mission of Christ is to restore souls whence they came. Need we wonder that 3 centuries before Christ, the most enlightened Greek, Aristotle, did not know how rightly to speak of the soul and its connection to the spirit? Need we wonder that when the crisis I have described awaited the souls of men, and Aristotle had no knowledge of the Savior that was to come, that he should have spoken erroneously of the soul? No, indeed, we need not. Further instruction will be necessary to explain why, for so long, people spoke erroneously of the connection of soul and spirit, as in the writings of Aristotle. The significance of Christ to the souls of men is seen in the light that reveals man as a threefold being consisting of body, soul, and spirit, and in the inner connection that exists between objective events and moral events. This connection will never be seen in its true form, unless this threefold membership of man is recognized. This lecture has been merely introductory. In it I have but hinted at the depths of the human soul to which we must penetrate, if we are in some measure to gain insight into the mystery of Golgotha. Much of what I have said may have been presented to you for the first time, and may therefore be as seed which will only spring in later ages, for it is only gradually that we become fully awake. We live in an age in which there are many things that we cannot fully grasp. This is seen in the difficulty men have to understand with full consciousness the painful events that are immediately approaching us, and which unfortunately it is neither possible to explain shortly nor to indicate how they should be understood. The end of Lecture 2.